Lecture 4, The Path to Nirvana.
In our last lecture, we began our study of the Buddha's teaching, of the Buddha's Dharma, by talking about the first of the Four Noble Truths. It was the truth of suffering, and we talked a bit about one of the classic interpretive problems that are connected with this doctrine, the problem that we simply call problem of pessimism. And it seems, on the face of it, to be pretty pessimistic. And we came to the conclusion at the end of that discussion that it wasn't exactly pessimistic. From a Buddhist point of view, it's simply realistic, and it leads to a certain quality of buoyancy and lightness and freedom in relation to a lot of the things that otherwise make people rather fearful and concerned about letting go of many of the pleasurable and valuable and lovely things about experience in this life. In this lecture, we want to move on from that discussion of the first noble truth to talk about the other three, the final three categories or topics of discussion that help us get some sort of a sense of the basic outline of Buddhist teaching, the teaching out of which so much of the rest of the tradition eventually evolved. So let's begin with the second noble truth, which is the truth of the origin of suffering. It's said, of course, in the classic accounts of the Buddha's life, that when he was under the tree of his awakening, he understood not just that everything was suffering, but that everything had an origin, it came from a certain cause, and could lead eventually to an experience of freedom from the suffering that afflicts so many aspects of human life. The origin of suffering is explained in classic Buddhist doctrine by a causal sequence that's known as the 12-fold chain of dependent arising. The Pali word for this chain is the longest Pali word that we'll encounter in our study of this aspect of the tradition. It's called paticca samuppada. If we were all together in a classroom, I'd get you to repeat that after me, but there's something about the barrier of this technology that seems to make that impossible. But I'll say it one more time, and you can roll it off your own tongues. Paticca samuppada. The T is particularly nice, actually. You make that sound by putting the tip of your tongue in the roof of your mouth. Paticca samuppada. Dependent co-arising. Things come into existence by depending on a whole bunch of causes. That's basically what that concept means. Now, we could go through all 12 of the links in the chain, and it would be somewhat bewildering. I've always found the chain to be a little bit confusing, especially in some of the links, because it seems historically that it really is a combination of two attempts to explain the origin of suffering that have been cemented together. So I think it's more valuable to just single out the key links that seem to, in one way or another, express for us the view of the world that is encapsulated in this vision of the origin of suffering. The first link that's important is the link that leads from ignorance to desire. The idea here is that if you have a misconception about the nature of things, out of that misconception can come some sort of a desire for those things. So ignorance is really the start of the chain. And then out of the desire comes birth. So you have a process here where ignorance leads to some kind of desire or thirst for some particularly desirable object. And then out of that desire, we try in one way or another to bring that object into being. So ignorance is the initial cause that fuels the chain of conditions that bring us back into the cycle of samsara. Now, to understand what Buddhists have in mind when they make this series of connections, one way to work with it might be to imagine something like a glossy advertisement, to simply put ourselves in the world of marketing and imagine an advertisement that creates an image for ourselves, as fantastic as that may be, of some extraordinarily desirable thing or experience or trip or whatever that may be, and ask what kinds of illusions it fosters, what kinds of desires it's meant to arouse, and what comes into being as a result of all of those desires. Obviously, most of those illusions for the large body of our experiences are pretty benign, but they feed a process that for Buddhists leads eventually to more of the cycle of death and rebirth. This is the engine, as it were, that fuels the cycle of samsara. And the most fundamental form of ignorance, of course, is not just ignorance about physical things that are outside ourselves, but ignorance about the self in the form that we just discussed in the last lecture. The ignorance that I, as a person, constitute some kind of permanent ego that needs to be fed by new and desirable experiences or new and desirable possessions. So that really explains for us the origin of suffering. It's a very simple picture, really. It's not one that is difficult to grasp, and it pins the principal responsibility for the energy of samsara on ignorance, some kind of misconception about the nature of the world and the nature of the self. Now, the third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the truth of Nirvana, or Nibbana, tells us that when someone begins to cultivate an awareness of no self, begins to understand that in some kind of deep and experiential way, and begins to strip away the desires that feed the fire of this cycle, it's possible eventually for the fire of samsara to burn out. This obviously is not easy in Buddhist experience, but it is possible for anyone to achieve the same cessation of samsara that was experienced by the Buddha himself, even though it may take many lifetimes. And it's usually understood in Southeast Asia that nirvana doesn't come particularly easily. It's something that takes many, many lifetimes to achieve and happens very rarely. This cessation is known, of course, by the name nirvana, which means simply to blow out, as if one were extinguishing the flame of a candle. Nirvana can be understood, perhaps, as the blowing out of desire. That's one way to read the word. It also could be the blowing out of ignorance, or if you wanted to take a really hard interpretation of the concept, you could see it as the blowing out of life itself, if you think of life as this repetitive cycle of death and rebirth. Nirvana comes at two moments, classically, in the discussion of the Buddha's life, at the moment of his awakening, when he understood that he was no longer adding fuel to the fire that fed his personality, and at the moment of his parinirvana, at his death, when the fire of the personality finally flickered out. Technically, in the terminology of classic Buddhist thought, these two moments are called nirvana with residues and nirvana without residues. Like the concept of suffering, we're here once again in this problematic world of negativity. It seems on the face of it that the concept of nirvana is very negative and difficult for us anyway, as Western people, to put any kind of positive spin on. I have often encountered, sometimes, you know, in more vocal ways than others, people who really react pretty negatively to the concept of nirvana, as I have just laid it out for you here. One particularly vocal and wonderful group of human beings once challenged me about this concept when I was lecturing at the Navy War College in Newport, Rhode Island. I don't often go down to speak to Navy officers about issues like nonviolence and nirvana, but by some marvelous good fortune, perhaps by the influence of something that I've done in a past life, whatever it was that caused me to be invited to go and speak to them about all of this. I laid out the concept of nirvana as I always do. Well, the concept of nirvana means literally to blow out or extinguish the desire or whatever that causes the cycle of death and rebirth, and one fairly taut and fit and obviously intelligent man raised his hand and he said, "Professor, I've got to tell you that this is the only time I have ever heard the concept of flame out spoken of as being a positive concept." I guess what little I know about the life of a pilot on an aircraft carrier, flame out is not a particularly good idea. But here in this case, flame out is good. In the case of nirvana, it's good to have the fire of samsara, of desire and ignorance, eventually burn out. But it does pose a problem for us. Again, what are we to make of such a negative image of the goal of human life? Here we have a religious tradition where the ultimate goal of human existence is to allow the fire that fuels this creative process of life after life eventually to extinguish itself. How can we understand that? How can we make sense of this idea? Well, I think the first thing that you have to say about it is that the concept of nirvana forces us to take seriously the negative Indian evaluation of samsara. I think very often for Western people, when we encounter the Indian doctrine of death and rebirth, our first impulse, emotionally, if not intellectually, is to say, well, you know, it's not such a bad idea. I wouldn't mind coming back a few times here. Maybe not a million times, but at least a few times, because there are some things that I've let go in this life that I wouldn't mind having a chance to pick up again. So you may not like it in traditional Buddhism, but for me, it looks like a pretty appealing thing. Not so in this tradition. The concept of nirvana shows us that in classic Indian Buddhism, the cycle of samsara is something that is best when it simply stops. So nirvana for us is an image simply of cessation. And it forces us to look seriously in the Buddhist tradition at all the different ways in which Buddhists are telling us that to cease activity is the goal of human life. This involves a major shift in our own imagination and in our own sense of what's valuable and important about human experience. Now, I often explore this with students by setting up a comparison and a contrast between this aspect of Buddhism and Judaism or Christianity. You know that according to Jewish and Christian tradition, there is a story, it's told about the process of creation, in which God, in some fashion, once looked out and saw that there was nothing. Call it perhaps primordial chaos. Call it, if you want, simply nothing, as in the classic Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And God made something come into being. That was that primordial act of creativity, in which God took nothing and made something come to be. And I think you'd agree with me that for Christian people or for Jewish people or for others who may in one way or another live in the context of this great story of creation, our job as people who in one way or another are acting or mirroring the image of God is to face the chaos of our lives, the nothing of our experience, and make something marvelously creative come into existence out of the nothing that we encounter in our world. So we put a tremendous value on creativity and the ability especially to create something out of nothing. And the Buddhist tradition, interestingly enough, has exactly the opposite image of human life. The Buddha is a person who looked out in his world, beginning perhaps with the four sights that he saw when he took his trip in through the park as a young man, certainly later in his experience as well. And he saw that life had been going on from beginningless time. Samsara has no beginning in the Indian tradition. It had been going on from beginningless time. And he discovered a way in his own experience to make some of that stop. So instead of creating something out of nothing, he, as it were, created nothing out of something. And that model is a model that he bequeaths to us. He gives to us to follow if we place ourselves in his tradition and follow his example. So the first thing to say about the negativity in the apparent negativity in the concept of nirvana is that it's there and it's important. And it forces us to take seriously an aspect of the Indian evaluation of the cycle of samsara that we might not be inclined to take seriously when we first encounter it. But the second thing to say about nirvana that also is important, I think, and helps us understand why the concept is so immensely appealing to Buddhists, is that the experience of nirvana is not just limited to the moment of the Buddha's death. It doesn't just name that time when he himself as a personality simply ceased to exist. The Buddha also experienced nirvana at the moment of his awakening, when he knew that he was no longer bound by ignorance and desire, and no longer was enmeshed in the cycle of samsara. When we understand the concept this way, and when we encounter the experience this way, we can see that nirvana for Buddhists is not just the cessation of life. He lived for 40 years between that first moment of nirvana and the moment of his parinirvana. Nirvana is a quality of mind or a state of being that characterizes the Buddha's life for that whole 40-year period between his awakening and his death. And that period represents, you might say, the ultimate achievement of human life in Buddhist tradition. What does it look like? How would we characterize it for ourselves? Well, certainly the images that we have of the Buddha tell us that he was peaceful. He was very calm. Lots of his illusions and fears and concerns and hopes and desires had slipped away. He also was wise. He was able to see reality for what it was, to understand it and respond to it in its reality. He was unattached. There was nothing that bound him. And he was free. One of the words for nirvana that's very commonly used in the Buddhist tradition is the Indian word for freedom, for liberation. So we're talking here about a tradition in a sense of radical freedom, of detachment from the things that tie you to this world and drive the cycle of suffering. And I think it's also possible for us to imagine that he was able, out of this nirvana, to act with a certain quality of spontaneity, clarity of mind, perhaps even with a certain amount of compassion and attentiveness to the suffering of others. So we begin to build for ourselves an image that goes beyond simply the image of extinction, that pictures what's valuable and wonderful about the life of a Buddhist sage. Nirvana is indeed the cessation of samsara, but it also, in many respects for Buddhists, is the perfect fruition of these qualities of calm, wisdom, and freedom that can characterize a fulfilling human life. Now, if that's what nirvana is, how do you get it? What's the path that leads to nirvana? This takes us, of course, to the fourth and last of the Four Noble Truths, the path to the cessation of suffering. Classic accounts of the path are divided into eight categories. right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, I've always found that the eight categories somewhat mystify my mind, and I'd rather find some way to simplify them or at least group them in a way that would tell me a bit about the logic of their relationship. So I'm in the habit of grouping this system of eight together in a system of three that allows us to see a bit how Buddhists practice, organize their behavior in a way that will lead them eventually to the experience of nirvana. These three categories are sila, moral conduct, samadhi, or mental concentration, and panya, or wisdom. And these categories give us what I think is a pretty good and concise summary of Buddhist practice, what it means to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha. Let me just summarize them and give you a sense about how they function in Buddhist experience. Buddhist lay people are expected to observe five moral precepts: no killing, no stealing, no lying, no abusing sex, and no drinking intoxicants. The five basic moral prohibitions of Buddhist life. Monks are expected to observe five more, including, and I won't list all five, but including restrictions that they cannot eat after noon, they can't sleep on soft beds, and they can't handle gold and silver. And the restriction on soft beds has always been the one that has both puzzled and amused me the most, especially when I encounter Buddhist monks from a particularly ascetical tradition. I once was involved in the administration of a center at Harvard that had many visitors coming from religious traditions of Asia, and one day we invited into the center a remarkably ascetical and well-organized monk from Thailand, and we showed him his room, the room that we had set up for him to stay in, which I thought was, actually, I was kind of embarrassed. It was a pretty harsh and austere setting. The room itself didn't have any decoration on the walls, and the bed that we gave him had a very thin foam rubber pad that had probably not been changed in about, I'd say, 15 or 20 years. So it had become petrified so that it was probably not much better than sleeping on a piece of stone. And the monk took one look at this and thought that this was far too comfortable. So he took the foam rubber pad off the bed, put it on the floor, and slept on the chain link frame of the bed itself. I was taught one more important lesson about the austerity of Buddhist practice. So these are restrictions that are taken seriously and, of course, are important in the evolution of the tradition as a whole. And they all belong in that larger category of sila, moral precepts, prohibitions against certain kinds of behavior that might lead to unhelpful or unhealthy states of mind. The second category into which we would group the practice of the path is the category of mental concentration. And this is the category that I would identify with what we would call Buddhist meditation. The cultivation of the mind that allows you to focus on your experience and to become calm in such a way that you can see the world clearly for what it is. Now, our course here is obviously not meant to be a course in meditation. If you wanted to be instructed in meditation, I'm sure that there are some other and more wonderful ways for you to go about doing this, but it would be crazy for me not to tell you how you could start. So let's just imagine for ourselves what basic Buddhist meditation might be like. You would sit in a comfortable and stable way, in a chair perhaps, if that's the best place for you, or if you can get your legs into a cross-legged position so that you can sit stably on the floor, that would be wonderful too. You would keep your back straight, fold your hands in front of you, one hand over the other with your palm, with your thumbs just touching, and allow your body to relax. Allow the tension in your body just to begin to slip away from your head down to your neck, down to your shoulders, and down through the rest of your body. And then breathe in a natural way and focus on the movement of your breath. Counting with each breath. Until you reach the number 10. And then going back and counting again from 1. And as you do this, allow your attention to slip away from your busy, buzzing old head down into the pit of your stomach where your breathing centers. And as my old yoga teacher in India used to say, just let the thoughts slip out of your head like dirty water out of a bathtub, and allow the mind to become calm. This is sometimes referred to as mindfulness of breathing, and it's the mindfulness of the breath that is really the foundation of Buddhist meditation. Out of this, all other meditations grow, and it's a marvelous way to bring you to a state of calm, a state that Buddhists refer to as samadhi, mental concentration. This is really the heart of the practice, Buddhist meditation. Now, the third category that I want to mention that has to do with the practice of the path is the cultivation of wisdom. There are these three categories: moral precepts, mental concentration, and the cultivation of wisdom. What does it mean to be wise in the Buddhist tradition? To understand no self, really. To understand that basic insight into the nature of the world and the nature of the self. But of course, this can be understood in a far more sophisticated way, really, than what we've been able to talk about here ourselves. It's really through this door that the whole tradition of Buddhist philosophy comes to greet us. Wisdom is cultivated often in many traditions through a very sophisticated process of philosophical study. I could give you a capsule summary of that, I suppose, but in a way it might be better for me to tell you a story. Now, rather than to attempt to teach you philosophy, tell you a story about a great philosopher and an encounter that taught me a great deal, not just about the intellectual movement of the Buddhist philosophical tradition, but about the feeling that it brings to life. I once was asked to introduce the Dalai Lama to a group of people at Harvard and get him going on a lecture that had to do with the Buddhist idea of selfhood. I spoke a bit about how important it was and was for us to greet him and then turn things over to him. And he began to talk about the Buddhist concept of self by telling us how important it was for us to be compassionate to others. He began, in other words, by saying that we should be concerned about other people in a very simple way. That was, as it were, the starting point of his philosophical investigation of the nature of the self. And then he said, those of you who have studied some Buddhism realize that it's perhaps a bit naive to say that I should be concerned about someone else because I know that I have no self and others have no self either. So what do we mean by self? And he then went into a long philosophical disquisition about the 7 different reasons why there is no self. There is nothing to hold on to, and there's nothing in a way that we can name and designate in some effective way as being part of this transaction between ourselves and others. And then he came to the end of this, and he smiled, as he does. He has a wonderful smile. And he said, but if there is no self, who is it who told you this? One might well ask, who is it who told you all of this? And he said a word in Tibetan that I remember very distinctly, even though my Tibetan is not all that great. It was dak tsam. The translator translated it as the mere I. We might think that that had something to do with the I, E-Y-E, but what he was really referring to was the mere self. I would translate that phrase, actually not in the technical form of, sounds like a technical phrase, mere I. I would say, just me. Just me, the Dalai Lama. Or just me, you and me. Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist wisdom, Buddhist views of no self move back and forth between these two poles. The sharp analytical discrimination of the nature of the self that allows us to understand that there is nothing there that we can hold on to as a self, and then the wise and relaxed and calm experience of ourselves as active agents in the world of ordinary experience. That's the heart, it seems to me, of Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist wisdom.